rolled his eyes, took my hand together with the telephone, and gently guided it to my ear.
Herr Hitler?
I could hear the voice of Hotel Reserva Savatsky.
Hello, Herr Hitler?
Yes, I said. Hitler here! I've been trying to get hold of you for ages. Frau Bellini wanted you to know that the company is really happy. Well, I said, that is nice, but I had expected somewhat more.
More?
Savatsky asked, confused. My dear Herr Savatsky, I said dismissively, 3 newspaper articles are all well and good, but we do have greater goals.
Newspaper articles?
Savatsky roared.
Who's talking about newspaper articles? You've made it onto YouTube, and you're getting endless hits.
Then he lowered his voice and said, just between you and me, some people here wanted to drop you right after the show. I'm not going to name names, but just take a look.
Young people love you.
The sensibilities of young people are unadulterated, I said.
And that's why we've got to produce some new stuff straight away,
Savatsky said excitedly.
They're extending your slot. They want to do some short clips, too. You have to come to the office right away. Where are you?
At the kiosk, I said.
Great, Savatsky said. Stay right there. A taxi's on its way.
He hung up.
So?
The newspaper seller asked. Good news?
I held out my telephone. Can you use this to get to something which goes by the name of YouTube? Chapter 17. What had happened was this. By means of some technical appliance, someone had taken a recording of my appearance on Gagmez's program and inserted it into the internet work, in a place where everyone could exhibit their short films, and everybody could watch whatever they wanted without being dictated to by the Jewish gutter press. The Jews could offer up their pitiful efforts here too, but one could see directly what was happening. The Volk was watching my appearance with Gagmez over and over again. You could tell this from a figure beneath the film clip. Now, I do not place undue faith in statistics. I have had sufficient experience of party comrades and industrialists to know that careerists and other shady characters lurk everywhere, always happy to lend a hand when they can present figures in a positive light. They embellish them, or compare them with another figure, which makes their own look very attractive, while suppressing a dozen other statistics which would reveal a far less favourable reality. For this reason, I decided to address the task myself, and I checked the figures of some Jewish submissions. I even bit the bullet, one cannot be squeamish in these matters, and looked at the figures for that Chaplin film, The Great Dictator. Yes, the number of visitors here stretched into 7 figures, but one had to put this into its proper context. After all, Chaplin's cheap and shoddy effort was more than 70 years old, which translated into approximately 15,000 visitors per year. Still not an inconsiderable sum, but only on paper, of course, for one would have to assume a gradual decrease in interest. It is only natural that human curiosity for current events should be greater than that for dusty old goods, especially in a case like this, a black-and-white production, whereas people these days are used to Technicolor. One may thus assume that this film must have attracted most of its internet work visitors in the 1960s and 70s. These days there could only be around 100 per year at most, very likely film students, some rabbis, and other such specialist viewers. Over the past 3 days, I had easily surpassed this figure by 1,000 times or more. I found it all very interesting, for one specific reason in particular. Until that point, my most positive experiences with public enlightenment and propaganda had been with methods considerably different from those employed today. I had worked with columns of S.A. brownshirts who waved flags from the backs of lorries as they drove through the city, smashing their fists into the faces of Bolshevist Red Front fighters, cracking their skulls with clubs, and, with my full support, also trying to kick some sense with their jackboots into these bone-headed communists. Now I observed that evidently the mere attraction of an idea, a speech, could induce hundreds of thousands to watch and engage in intellectual debate. In truth, this was very hard to understand. It was even plain impossible. Something was niggling away at me. A hunch, if not a fear. So I immediately called Sensenbrink. He was in great spirits.
"Have you seen the figures?" he rejoiced. "You've just hit 700,000 and the numbers are going north all the time. It's madness. You're out of the ballpark."
"Indeed," I said, not quite understanding everything he had said.
"But I find your delight quite overblown. It can't possibly make any sense."
"What? What do you mean? You're our golden goose, old chap. Believe me, this is just the launch pad. It's a game changer, a paradigm shift. But you'll still have to pay all the people."
"Which people?"
"I was myself in charge of propaganda for a while, and I know that to bring 700,000 people over to your side, you need 10,000 men, and they have to be fanatical."
10,000 men? What 10,000 men?
10,000 stormtroopers, theoretically, and that's a conservative estimate. But I don't imagine you have an SA yet, do you? So you will need at least 15,000.
"You really are a few sandwiches short of a picnic," Sensenbrink said.
I had no idea what he was going on about, although he sounded cheerful enough. I couldn't be sure, but I thought I heard glasses clinking in the background.
"But watch out. One day someone's going to take you seriously."
And he hung up.
And so the matter appeared resolved. Sensenbrink clearly had nothing to do with it. The endorsement seemed to be from the Volk itself.
Sensenbrink could have been an unscrupulous liar, of course, a charlatan. These doubts still lingered, which is precisely the risk one faces when one has not hand-picked one's subordinates oneself. But overall he seemed to be a trustworthy fellow, and so I embarked on the production of additional material for the programme. As always, when people are overtaxed creatively, they come up with the most dubious suggestions. I was to film bizarre reports such as "The Führer pays a visit to the bank," or "The Führer at the swimming pool." I dismissed such claptrap out of hand. Having to watch politicians engage in sport is little more than an embarrassment for the Volk. My sporting activities were brought to a swift conclusion after my takeover of power. Football players, dancers, they are the ones people want to see, executing their moves to perfection. Their disciplines may even rise to the height of great art. In athletics, for example, a consummate javelin throw is a magnificent sight to behold. But then imagine that someone like Goering comes along, or that matron chancellor. Who would want to watch either of those two whales attempt the sprint hurdles? It would not be a pretty sight. Of course, there are some who will argue, she ought to show the Volk that she's a dynamic leader. For this, she need not venture into show jumping or rhythmic gymnastics, but rather something more harmless, such as golf. Surely that would be feasible. Such would be the discussion in conservative Anglophile circles. But anybody who has seen golf played to a high standard would certainly not want to watch a shapeless old trout fiddling about for hours on the course. And what are the other statesmen to say? In the mornings, she painstakingly follows the intricacies of economic policy. In the afternoons, she is out on the golf course taking ungraceful swipes at the turf. And as for appearing in swimming trunks, well, that is the most preposterous thing imaginable. You couldn't dissuade Mussolini from doing it, and more recently that suspect Russian leader has been doing it too. An interesting fellow, no question, but as far as I am concerned, it is a foregone conclusion. The moment a politician removes his shirt, his policies are dead in the water. All he will say is, "Look, my dear fellow countrymen, I have made the most extraordinary discovery. My policies look better without a shirt on." What sort of nonsensical proposition is that? I have even read that a German war minister was lately photographed with a wench in a swimming pool, while his troops were in the field, or at least preparing for deployment. Had I been in charge, this would have been the gentleman's last day in office. I wouldn't have bothered with a letter of resignation. You lay a pistol on his desk, a bullet in the chamber, you leave the room, and if the blackguard has an ounce of decency, he knows what he has to do. And if not, the following morning, the bullet's in his brain, and he's face down in the pool. Then everyone else in the ministry knows what to expect if you stab your troops in the back while wearing swimming trunks. No, bathing larks were out of the question as far as I was concerned.
So what do you want to do instead if that's not up your street?
This question was fired at me by one Ulf Bronner, an assistant director, in his mid-30s perhaps, and a strikingly ill-dressed man. Still, he was not kitted out as shabbily as the cameramen. Through my recent work for and with broadcasting companies, I have discovered that they are the scruffiest-looking individuals in any form of employment, outdone only by press photographers. I have no idea why it should be thus, but as far as I can make out, press photographers seem to wear the ragged cast-offs of television cameramen. Perhaps they imagine that nobody will ever see them, because, after all, the camera is in front of their faces. Whenever I come across an unflattering picture of someone in a magazine, they may be grimacing or similar, I frequently wonder what the photographer must have looked like. This Bronner fellow was better dressed than that, but not much. "I deal with politics," I said, "as well as with issues that extend beyond politics."
"How on earth is that meant to be funny?"
Bronner grumbled.
"All politics is crap, but it's not my show, is it?"
Over the years, I have learned that fanatical belief in the common cause is not always essential, and in some matters it can even be a hindrance. I have seen directors who, for art's sake, were incapable of producing a comprehensible film. Ultimately, I preferred Bronner's indifference. At least it allowed me a pretty free hand when it came to pillorying the woeful achievements of the democratically elected political representatives. And as one should always simplify things where possible, I plumped for the most elementary topic, literally so. I began one morning by standing outside a kindergarten. Next door to the unconventional school, I had by now passed on many an occasion. Time and again, I had observed the irresponsible behaviour of automobile drivers, who raced past at high speed, carelessly putting at risk the lives and well-being of our children. In a brief speech, I launched a brutal attack on this speeding frenzy. Then we took some film of these asinine would-be child murderers, which could later be cut into the programme. The reactions we elicited were extraordinary.
"Are you doing that hidden camera programme?"
"Absolutely not, my dear woman. The camera is here, do you see?" I pointed to the recording device and my camera comrades, addressing her gently and patiently, for a woman's understanding of technical matters is always somewhat fragile. When I had finished my explanation, I inquired whether the woman was a regular visitor to the area. "Which means these automobilists may well have come to your attention."
"Yes," she said slowly.
"Why do you ask?"
"Would you agree with me that, in view of the behaviour exhibited by a veritable myriad of automobilists, one must fear for the children who play here?"
"I suppose, sort of, but what are you getting at?"
"Voice your concerns as freely as you wish, my dear woman and comrade."
"Hold on, I'm nobody's comrade. But seeing as you ask, I do sometimes get a bit worked up when I'm going past here with the children."
"Why then does this freely elected government not mete out harsher punishments to such thoughtless races?"
"I don't know."
"We will change this. For Germany, you and I, which punishments would you recommend?"
"Which punishments would I recommend?"
"Do you think that the existing punishments are adequate?"
"I'm not sure."
"Or are they not dispensed harshly enough?"
No, I wouldn't want that."
"What do you mean? What about the children?"
"I mean, it's all right as it is. I'm perfectly happy." This was a frequent response. It was like living in a climate of fear, and this under a form of government which was supposed to be so free. The simple, innocent woman from the Volk dare not speak openly in my presence when I approached her in my plain soldier's uniform. I was appalled. And this was the reaction from approximately three-quarters of the people to whom I spoke. The other quarter asked, "Are you the new security guard around here?" Finally, someone's saying something. It's an absolute disgrace. They should all be locked up. "You are calling for imprisonment, then?" "At the very least. I thought the death penalty had been abolished. More's the pity." Following that same principle, I now lashed out at whatever ills I observed, either with my own eyes or in the press reports. Poisoned food. Automobilists who telephoned with their portable devices while driving their vehicles. The barbaric custom of hunting, and much more. And what astounded me was that people either demanded draconian punishments or, as was more frequent, dared not speak their minds. There was one occasion where this was particularly manifest. A large number of people had already gathered in the city centre to demonstrate against the government. Seemingly, it had occurred to no one to opt for the most obvious solution, stormtroopers, but at least they had erected a kind of market stall to collect signatures, aimed at eliminating the sensationally high figure of 100,000 abortions per year in Germany. Such large-scale extermination of German blood is unacceptable to me too, of course. Any cretin could see that, assuming 50% were boys, this would lead to a loss of 3 divisions in the medium term, if not 4. In my presence, however, these upright, decent people were unwilling to articulate their beliefs, and shortly after we arrived, the demonstration broke up altogether. "What can one say?" I asked Bronner. "All of a sudden, these poor people seem changed. So much for so-called freedom of expression." "Incredible," Bronner gasped. "That was even better than the thing with the dog owners protesting against compulsory leads." "No," I said, "you misunderstood. The dog owners who bolted were not decent Germans. They were all Jews. Didn't you see the stars? They knew at once who they were dealing with." "Those weren't Jews," Bronner protested. "That wasn't Jew written on the stars, it was dog." "There you go, so typical of the Jew," I explained. "All he does is sow confusion, and then on the flames of bewilderment he cooks up his greasy, poisonous soup." "But that's..." Bronner panted, and then he laughed. "You are absolutely unbelievable." "I know," I said. "By the way, have the uniforms for your camera people arrived? In future, the movement must appear united." Our revelations were greeted with wild enthusiasm back in the offices of the production company. "You could even turn a vicar into an atheist." Madame Bellini laughed as she viewed the material. "You might think so, but I've already made considerable efforts in that direction," I recalled. "Not even a stint inside a camp does the trick for many of those devil dodgers." The short films were included in Gagmez's programme as soon as 2 weeks after my premiere, and were in addition to the passionate oration I delivered towards the end. After a further 4 weeks, I was commissioned to provide yet another segment. To all intents and purposes, it was like the beginning of the '20s all over again, with the difference that, back then, I took possession of a party. This time, it was a television programme. Moreover, my assessment of that Gagmez character was proved accurate. A certain resentment had fermented within him as he witnessed my increasing influence and sway on his programme, and the Führer principle asserting itself ever more definitively. And yet the man offered no resistance to this development. Although he did not exactly fall into line, his protests were lame, while behind the scenes he would occasionally give those in charge a good earful. In his shoes, I would have gone for broke. From the very start, I would have refused point blank to tolerate any interference, My response to that first appearance would have been to threaten to cease all work for the company. What would I have cared for contracts? But Gagmess behaved true to form. In desperation, he clung to his sorry achievements, to his doubtful fame, to his television slot, as if it were an accolade. This Gagmess would never have put his neck on the line for his convictions. He would never have gone to prison. On the other hand, what convictions could he possibly foster? What did he have, apart from a shadowy background, apart from meaningless, vainglorious tittle-tattle? I had it far easier. Behind me was Germany's future. Not to mention the Iron Cross, or the wound badge, which proved that I had already sacrificed blood for Germany. What had Gagmess ever sacrificed? Naturally, I was not expecting to see him parading the golden wound badge. How could he have acquired one of those without a war? And if he had acquired one, it is highly debatable whether he would have been a suitable candidate for his entertainment program. When one takes a closer look at the men who have been awarded such rare, distinguished honors, one notices that there is not much left of the poor blighters. That is in the brutal nature of things. These are men who were wounded at the front 5 times or more by bayonets, grenades, gas. Men who have glass eyes or artificial limbs, or whose mouths are contorted, if they possess a lower jaw at all. This is not the wood from which destiny carves us the best humorists. And while a certain bitterness may well be understandable in their situation, the Führer must also consider the other side. The people in the audience have dressed up for the occasion and are sitting there in high spirits. After a hard day's toil in the shrapnel factory or maintenance hangar, or even a long night of heavy bombing, they wish to relax. And I fully understand that they might expect something more from a comedian than 2 amputated legs. So let me state here emphatically that, for all concerned, a lethal direct hit from a grenade must be better than a wound badge followed by a career as a clown on the home front. What struck me immediately about Gagmess was that not only did he lack an ideology to rival National Socialism, he lacked an ideology altogether. And of course, without an established ideology, in the modern entertainment industry, one hasn't got a chance, nor even a raison d'être. The rest is taken care of by history, or the viewing figures. Chapter 18. The Führer is nothing without his Volk. That is to say, the Führer is, of course, something, even without his Volk, but nobody can see what he is. Any person sound of mind can be made to understand this. It is as if you had sat Mozart down and not given him a piano. How would anyone have noticed that he was a genius? He would not even have been the performing Wunderkind alongside his sister. True, she would have had her violin, but if we take the violin away too, then what is left? 2 children who can at most recite poems in the Salzburg dialect or perform other such displays of cuteness. But who would pay to watch what takes place in any parlour at Christmas time? The Führer's violin, however, is the Volk and his cohorts. Yes, I know, one can already predict the response of the sceptics, those smart alecks who prattle on about how one cannot play 2 violins at the same time. But let us examine their perspective on reality. That which must not, cannot be. But what if it is? A large number of even truly great Führers have foundered on this very point. Take Napoleon, for example. The man was a genius, no question about it, but only on his military violin. He foundered on account of his cohorts. And so, of every genius, one must ask, what sort of cohorts has he chosen? Take Frederick the Great. He had Kurt Christoph Graf von Schwerin, a general who was shot from his horse for his country, banner still in hand. Or Hans Karl von Winterfeld, chopped to bits by sabres in 1757. My goodness, those were cohorts. But Napoleon? It must be said he was dealt an unfortunate hand, and that is putting it politely. Nepotism of the worst sort. His relations were queuing up for jobs. His half-wit brother, Joseph, sits there in Spain. Bernadotte marries his sister-in-law. Jerome acquires Westphalia. The sisters are furnished with an array of principalities in Italy. And does anybody thank him? But the most egregious parasite of all was Louis, whom Napoleon had installed as King of Holland, and who spent his time there honing his royal career to his heart's content, as if he had conquered the place himself. With leeches such as these, how can one possibly wage war or rule the world? Not only have I always set great store by having impeccable cohorts, for the most part I have found them too. I mean, just look at the siege of Leningrad. 2 million civilians trapped without food. A certain sense of duty was required to drop thousands of bombs each day, especially targeting the food stores. In the end, the burghers of Leningrad reached the point where they smashed in each other's skulls, only to be able to gobble up the soil into which the burned sugar had melted. Naturally, from a racial standpoint, these civilians were not worth preserving, but the simple soldier might easily have thought, those poor, poor people. Especially as many of these soldiers are so terribly fond of animals. I experienced this at first hand in the trenches, where men would dash into the most violent barrage of fire just to retrieve Mornsey, or share the rations they had been saving up for weeks with stray little Bello. This is just another example of how wartime stirs not only the harshest emotions in men, but the softest, warmest ones too. In many respects, armed conflict chisels out the best in people. The simple man goes into battle an unhewn chunk of stone, emerging as a flawless animal lover with the implacable will to do what is necessary. And one knows one has the right cohorts when these simple people, these hundreds of thousands of soldiers and cat lovers, do not say, let's go more gently on them. If it comes to the worst, at least the Leningraders will starve more slowly. But rather, let's get going with these bombs. The Führer knows what he's doing with his orders. The right consorts, I pondered again, as I observed Fräulein Krömeyer typing up my latest Führer speech. I was entirely satisfied with Fräulein Krömeyer's efforts overall. Her work could not be faulted. Her commitment was exemplary, and, of late, she had been at my disposal for the whole day. The only area where there was room for improvement was her appearance. Not that she looked dishevelled or unkempt, but this outwardly sombre impression, which flew in the face of her affability, this death-like pallor, was hardly conducive to such a joyous and life-affirming movement as National Socialism. On the other hand, a Führer must have the capability to see beneath the surface. Von Ribbentrop, for example, was in appearance a model example of the master race, a perfect chin, first-class genetic material. But ultimately, the man was a perennial twit, and that is no use to anybody. Very good, Fräulein Krömeyer, I said. I think that is all for today.
I'll, just quickly print it out for you, she said.
She typed something into her computer. Then she took a small mirror from her bag, together with a dark lipstick, and started painting over her lips. This seemed an appropriate opportunity to broach the subject. What does your fiancé say about this?
What fiancé? About what? Mein Führer?
Her Führer address still needed some practice. Well, I suppose there's a young man. There must be a young man. An admirer, let's say.
No,
Fräulein Krömeyer said as she applied her lipstick.
There's no one.
Well, I should not like to be indiscreet or insistent, I reassured her. But you can tell me. I mean, we're not amongst Catholics here. I can see no objection if two young people like one another,
Why should a marriage certificate be necessary?
True love ennobles itself.
That's all well and good, Fräulein Kurmeier said, pressing her lips together as she looked into the mirror. But at the moment, there isn't, like, anybody. Because 4 weeks ago, I personally told him where to get off. He was a right douchebag, let me tell you.
I must have appeared somewhat taken aback, for Fräulein Kurmeier immediately said,
OMG, that just, like, totally slipped out, LOL. We can't have that in Führer headquarters. What I meant to say, of course, was that the man was an absolute Schweinhund, mein Führer.
I did not really understand the point of this rephrasing, or how it constituted an improvement. At any event, the expression on her face radiated honest effort, and now a certain pride, too, at having come up with this second formulation.
First of all, I said sternly, we are not in Führer headquarters, strictly speaking, because I am not Commander-in-Chief of the Wehrmacht. Not yet, at any rate. And second, I do not think that such words should spring from the mouth of a German girl. And definitely not from the mouth of my secretary.
But that's what it was like. You should have been there. You'd have said something similar. I could tell you a few tales.
Such tales mean nothing to me. All that is important here is the appearance of the German Reich. And in these rooms, the image of the German woman, too. If somebody walks past, I want him to gain the impression of a well-ordered state, and not...
That was as far as I got. For a tear ran from one of Fräulein Kurmeier's eyes, then from the other, followed by a great many tears all round. These are the very moments which the Führer must avoid in wartime, as empathy may rob him of the concentration urgently required for the victorious execution of cauldron battles and carpet bombing.
When the situation is less favourable, so I discovered, it is somewhat easier.
You give the order that every metre of ground must be defended until the last drop of blood is spilled, and then the job of waging war is effectively finished for the day. One might as well go home. All the same, one must never allow oneself to get bogged down in other people's emotions.
Admittedly, we were not in the middle of a war, and I had the highest regard for Fräulein Kurmeier's faultless output. So I handed her a paper handkerchief, which seemed to be in widespread manufacture once more.
There's no real damage done, I said soothingly. All I wanted was that in future you...
I mean, I do not doubt your ability. Indeed, I am highly satisfied with your work. You should not take the admonishment to heart.
Oh, she sniffed. It's not because of you. It's just that, well, I really loved him. I thought we were going places. You know, like, totally serious.
She rifled through her rucksack and retrieved her telephone. She tapped around on it a few times until it showed a photograph of the Schweinhund, then held it out to me.
He was so totally good-looking, and he was, like, always so, so special.
I looked at the picture. The man did indeed look handsome. He was tall, blonde, if a good dozen years older than Fräulein Kurmeier. The photograph showed him on the street, in an elegant suit, but there was nothing dandyish about him. Rather, he looked extraordinarily dignified, as if he were the manager of a wholesome small business.
I should not wish to offend, I said. But now I am not at all surprised that this relationship came to an unhappy conclusion.
No? Fräulein Kurmeier sniffed.
No.
Why?
Look, naturally, you think that you ended the relationship. But, in all honesty, have you not recognized that you are not the right partner for this man?
Fräulein Kurmeier sniffed and nodded.
But we were, like, so good together. And then I never imagined...
Of course, I said. But you can see it at once.
She crumpled the handkerchief in her fist as she looked up at me.
What? You can see it.
I took a deep breath. It is astonishing how, in the struggle for the future of the German folk, Providence can drive one to the most far-flung secondary theatre of war. Yet it is also amazing how Providence brings some things together and combines them. The problem of Fräulein Kröhmeier and the dignified representation of racial policy. Look, a man, precisely a racially untarnished man such as he, surely wants a cheerful, life-affirming partner, a mother for his children, a wife who exudes the wholesome spirit of National Socialism.
But that's what I am, like totally.
Yes, of course, I said. You know that, and I know it too. But just look at yourself through the eyes of a man in the prime of his life. This black wardrobe all the time, this dark lipstick, this face which you always make up to look so pale, or at least that is the impression I get. Now, Fräulein Kröhmeier, please do not start crying again, I beg you. In 1916, I saw corpses on the Western Front that looked jollier than you. Those dark eyes, and set against your black hair, you are such a charming young lady. Why don't you wear some cheerful clothes for a change? A gay blouse, or a pretty skirt, or a bright summer frock. Then you will see how gentlemen turn their heads. Fräulein Kröhmeier stared at me, as still as a statue. Then she let out a hearty laugh.
I just had to picture it, she explained. Me, like, going around in a little dress like Heidi of the Alps, LOL, with flowers in my hair, and then, like, bumping into him in the pedestrian zone, him and his fancy lady, and then finding out that the shit is married. OMG, I must say, I would look even sillier than usual. No, it's a really funny image. That's so sweet of you to, like, cheer me up, she said. And now I'm off home.
She stood up and put her rucksack over her shoulder.
I fetched the speech from the printer and put it in your pigeonhole, she said, her hand already on the door handle. Have a nice evening, mein Führer. Mean, like a little dress. LOL.
She left. I wondered what I might get up to that evening. Maybe I should return to the hotel and have that new device connected which Sensenbrink had ordered for me. It was supposed to allow you to play films via the television set, films which, for practicality's sake, were no longer preserved on spools but on little plastic discs. The Flashlight Company had shelves full of them. I always enjoyed films, and I was curious to discover what I may have missed in the intervening decades. My other thought was to get started on my design for the future space airport in Berlin. After all, experience had shown that when one is actively waging war, one scarcely gets the time to attend to such matters. And thus it seemed wise to pursue my former passion with increased vigour now. The door opened again, and Fräulein Kröhmeier put a letter on my desk.
I found this in your pigeonhole, she said. It didn't arrive with the post. Someone must have just slipped it through the letterbox. Have a good evening again, mein Führer.
The letter was indeed addressed to me, but the sender had written my name with inverted commas, as if it were intended as the title of a television program. I gave it a good sniff. In the past, it had quite often transpired that women had wanted to express a certain reverence for my person. The letter smelled of nothing. I opened it. Even now, I can clearly recall the enthusiasm I felt on seeing an immaculate swastika at the top of the letter. I had not counted on such positive reactions so soon. Apart from that, There was nothing to see. I unfolded the letter. Below, in fat, black, clumsy handwriting, it said, "Stop all your shit, you fucking Jewish bastard." I hadn't laughed so much in ages. Chapter 19. It was a minor triumph, and very satisfying, when the young lady at the hotel reception greeted me with the Nazi salute. I was on my way to the breakfast room, and by the time I answered her greeting by flipping back my arm, she was already lowering hers.
"I can only do that because you get up so late and there's no one about."
She winked at me. "So don't give me away." "It's difficult at the moment, I know," I said in a hushed tone. "But the time will come again when you too will be able to hold your head high and display your pride in the fatherland." Then I hastened into the breakfast room. Not all the serving folk had seen the signs of the times as clear-sightedly as the young lady at the reception. There was no clicking of heels, and the only greeting I received was a hollow good morning. On the other hand, since I had switched to wearing suits more often, the looks people cast me were more friendly than before. Conditions here were similar to those in the Weimar era, after my release from prison. Here, too, I needed to begin from the very bottom, with the difference that the influence and mores of the effete bourgeoisie had eaten more deeply into the proletariat. In order to establish a certain level of trust, Uncle Wolf had to attire himself in the sheep's clothing of the bourgeoisie, even more so than in the past. And in the mornings, as I partook of my muesli and orange juice with linseeds, I could palpably sense an acknowledgement of my past achievements in the looks people afforded me. I was just debating whether to get up and fetch another apple when I heard the Valkyries galloping on their steeds. With a confident movement I had seen performed by a number of young businessmen, I brought out the telephone and raised it to my ear. "Hitler," I said in a commendably discreet voice. "Have you read the paper yet?" the voice of Madame Bellini asked straight away. "No," I said. "Why?" "Then take a look. I'll call you back in 10.
"Wait," I said. "What do you mean? What newspaper are we talking about here?"
"The one with your picture on the cover," Madame Bellini said. I stood up and went over to the pile of newspapers, where there were a few copies of that Bild. On the cover was a photograph of me, together with the headline, "Loony YouTube Hitler, Fans Go Wild for His Tirades." I took the paper back to my table and sat down. Then I started to read. "Loony YouTube Hitler, Fans Go Wild for His Tirades. The nation is stumped. Is this humor? Once upon a time he murdered millions. Now millions have made him a YouTube sensation. With his tasteless routine and bizarre catchphrases, a comedian dressed up as Adolf Hitler is venting hatred against foreigners, women, and democracy in Ali Gagmez's show Epic Guys. Youth protection workers, politicians, and the Central Council of Jews are appalled. Fancy a sample of his art? The Turks have no creative genius. 100,000 abortions per year are intolerable. Later, this will cost us 4 divisions for the war in the East. Cosmetic surgery is racial defilement. This Nazi rabble-rousing is awakening bad memories amongst older Germans. Pensioner Hilda W., 92, from Dormagen, said, "It's terrible. That man did so much harm. Politicians can scarcely believe his success. According to CSU Minister Markus Söder, the whole thing is sheer madness. It's got nothing to do with humor." SPD health expert Karl Lauterbach told Bild, "It's extremely borderline and offensive." Green leader Claudio Roth, "Dreadful. I turn off whenever I see him." Dieter Garman, president of the Central Council of Jews, "Incredibly poor taste. We're considering lodging an official complaint."
Particularly bizarre is the fact that no one knows the real name of this comedian, who bears a terrifyingly close resemblance to the Nazi monster. In an attempt to find out more, Bild questioned the boss of MyTV, Elke Fahrendonk. Bild: what has any of this got to do with humour and satire?
Fahrendonk:
because Hitler shows up the extreme contradictions in our society, his controversial approach is justified from an artistic point of view.
Bild:
why won't the loony TV Hitler tell us what his real name is?
Fahrendonk:
Atze Schröder's no different in this respect. He has every right to a private life, too.
Bild promises to monitor the case closely.
I have to admit that I was astounded. Not by the paper's outlandish take on reality, something I have encountered only too often in the past. It is well known that the biggest fools are generally to be found on the editorial boards of the national press. But because I sensed this Bild newspaper was an institution which might turn out to be a secret ally. A little uptight, maybe, with a typical petty bourgeois subservience which recoiled from speaking its mind. But on many issues, the position it took was not dissimilar to my own. When I heard the daughters of Wotan soar across the skies once more, I reached for the telephone.
Hitler:
I'm disgusted, Madame Bellini said. They didn't give us any warning.
What do you expect from a newspaper?
I'm not talking about Bild. I'm talking about MyTV, she said, in a state of high excitement. They interviewed Fahrendonk. At the very least, I thought we might have been told in advance.
What difference would that have made?
None, she sighed. You're probably right. In the end, it is only a newspaper, I said. It is of no interest to me.
Maybe not to you, Madame Bellini said, but it is to us. They want to bring you down, and we've invested rather a lot in you.
What is that supposed to mean? I asked curtly.
It means, Madame Bellini said in a cooler tone, that we have arranged an interview with Bild, and that we need to talk.
Why do we need to talk?
Because once they've got it in for you, they'll leave no stone unturned. I'd like you to tell me if there's anything they might dig up.
It is always exhilarating to watch our business leaders take fright. When the deal appears sufficiently tantalizing, they hurry over with beaming smiles, scarcely able to throw enough money at you. When everything goes well, they are at the front of the queue to increase their share, suggesting that they would have borne the whole risk. But the moment something looks perilous, they are the first to foist this lucrative risk onto others.
If that is your concern, I mocked her, then it has come too late. Do you not think you ought to have asked these questions earlier?
Madame Bellini cleared her throat. I'm afraid I have something to confess.
Which is?
We ran a check on you. Listen, don't get me wrong, we didn't have you tailed or anything like that, but we did hire a specialist agency. I mean, one needs to find out whether one is actually employing a devoted Nazi.
Well, I said peevishly, I imagine the results will have reassured you.
On the one hand, yes, Madame Bellini said. We didn't find anything bad.
And on the other?
On the other hand, we didn't find anything at all. It's as if you didn't exist.
I see. So now you would like me to tell you whether I existed before?
Madame Bellini paused a moment. Please don't get the wrong end of the stick. We're all in the same boat here. All we want to do is avoid the sort of situation where... Here she let out a rather forced laugh. We end up, without knowing it, of course, having someone like the real Hitler on our books.
She paused again before adding, I can hardly believe what I'm saying here.
Me neither, I said. It's high treason.
Can't you be serious for a minute? She asked. I want you to answer just one question for me, hand on heart.
Are you sure that the hacks at Bild won't unearth anything they could use against you?
Frau Bellini, I said. I have done nothing in my life of which I am ashamed. I have neither sought any unwarranted financial gain, nor have I ever acted purely in my own interest. This will be of little use in our dealings with the press, however. In this instance, we must assume that Bild will concoct a whole heap of ugly lies. I expect they will falsely attribute an array of illegitimate children to me once again. We know this is the worst thing the scurrilous, petty bourgeois press can think of. But I can live with such accusations.
Illegitimate children? Nothing else? What else do you imagine there might be? What about your political background, Nazi affiliation and that sort of thing?
My political background is above reproach.
So you were never a member of a right-wing party?
She probed.
What are you talking about?
I laughed at her clumsy trick question. I was practically one of the party's founders, member number 555.
I'm sorry?
I don't want you to go around thinking I was just some hanger-on.
Was that a youthful indiscretion, perhaps?
Once again, Madame Bellini made an awkward attempt to undermine my unimpeachable convictions.
What are you saying? Think about it. In 1919, I was 30. I even helped come up with the ruse. We invented the first 500 to make the numbers look better. It is a stunt I'm awfully proud of.
Let me reassure you. The worst that this newspaper will be able to print about me is that Hitler falsified his membership number. I think I can live with that. There was another pause on the other end of the line. Then Madame Bellini said,
1919?
Of course. When else do you think? You can only join a party once unless you leave it, and I certainly never left mine. She laughed and sounded relieved.
I can live with that too. YouTube Hitler fudged party entry in 1919. I'd almost pay to see a headline like that.
Return to your post, then, and hold your position. We will not surrender a meter.
Jawohl, mein Führer.
I heard Madame Bellini laugh before hanging up.
Dropping the newspaper onto the table, I suddenly found myself staring into gleaming blue eyes set beneath a mop of blonde hair. A boy, with his hands clasped timidly behind his back.
Well, well, I said. Who do we have here? What is your name?
My name is Reinhardt,
the whippersnapper said.
Really a delightful little chap.
How old are you? I asked.
Tentatively, he brought forth a hand and put up three fingers before eventually adding a fourth. Adorable.
I knew a Reinhardt once, I said, gently stroking his hair. He lived in Prague. Such a beautiful city.
Did you like him? The lad asked.
I liked him very much indeed, I said. He was a very good man. He made sure that lots of wicked people can't harm people like you and me any more.
How many?
The boy asked. I could see he was becoming more trustful. A huge number. Thousands. A very good, brave man.
Did he put them in prison?
Yes, I nodded. That too.
I bet they got their bottoms smacked.
This enchanting scallywag chortled, taking his other hand out from behind his back. He held out a copy of Bild.
Did you bring this for me? I asked.
He nodded.
From Mummy. She's sitting over there,
he said, pointing to a table in the distance. Then he pulled a felt-tipped pen from his trouser pocket.
Mummy said I have to ask you if you'll draw a auto on it.
A auto? I laughed. Are you sure? Or did Mummy say an autograph? The boy pulled the sweetest frown imaginable and thought hard. Then he cast me a look of consternation.
I don't know any more. Will you draw me a auto?
Why don't we ask Mummy?
I stood up, took the little fellow by the hand, and brought him back to his mother. I signed the newspaper for her, and also drew on a piece of paper a picture of a beautiful automobile. A magnificent 12-cylinder Maybach. As I returned to my seat, the telephone rang. It was Madame Bellini.
You do that very well, she said.
I like children, I said. I was unable to start my own family, but please stop watching everything I do.
What do you mean, children? She asked, sounding quite astonished. No, I mean you argue well, you're quick-witted. You're so good that Herr Sensenbrink and I thought we could offer them an interview right away, the Bild people.
I pondered this for a few seconds, then said, No, we're not going to do that. And by not doing it, we'll feature more frequently on their front page. We will grant them their interview when it suits us, and on our terms. Chapter 20 I am not often mistaken. On the contrary, I am very seldom mistaken. This is one of the advantages of not entering the political fray until one has had some proper experience of life. And let me emphasize here the word proper. These days there seems to be no end of self-styled politicians who, having stood behind a shop counter for a whole quarter of an hour, or once peered through an open door into a factory hall, now think they know what real life looks like. To take an example, I just have to think of that liberal Asiatic minister who abandoned his medical studies to concentrate on his career as a political non-entity. This begs the question, why? If, instead, he said he was concentrating on completing his medical studies, then aiming to work as a doctor for 10 or 20 years, 50 to 60 hours per week, so that afterwards, schooled by harsh reality, he could gradually form his own opinions and develop these into a view of the world, allowing him to embark on meaningful political work with a good conscience. He might have been somebody, given favourable enough circumstances. But no. This fellow is one of those ghastly modern types who think they should enter politics first and the ideas will somehow piece themselves together along the way. And indeed, this is precisely what it looks like. Today, they state the case for Jewish finance. Tomorrow, they're chasing after Jewish Bolshevism. This stripling is no different. He is like the class dunce, forever running after the bus. All I can say is, ugh! Had he waited until his first experience on the front line, unemployment, the men's hostel in Vienna, rejection by those professorial oafs of the academy, then he would know what he was talking about today. Errors would be committed only in exceptional circumstances. As with this Bild affair, in which I confess I had misread the situation. I had assumed that the press vermin would be all over me, my policies, my speeches. In fact, they sent a horde of photographers. 2 days later, a large picture appeared of me drinking tea from a paper cup at the newspaper kiosk. The vendor stood beside me holding a bottle of lemonade, which might have resembled a beer bottle. Above the photograph, in large type, was written, "Loony YouTube Hitler. Hanging out with his drinking buddies. In the evenings, he rails on telly against foreigners and our politicians. By day, he hangs out with his drinking buddies. Germany's most unsavory comedian, who calls himself Adolf Hitler, and still refuses to tell the country his real name, as reported in Bild. Having spruced himself up and put away his uniform, the Nazi humorist left is acting the innocent man on the street. Is he planning his next distasteful tirade? Watch this space." True, the newspaper vendor had not been having his best day sartorially. This was due to the fact that he had decided to undertake some renovations to his sales window, for which he had been wearing some decommissioned fatigues under a smock
that he removed in his cigarette breaks. He had looked no shabbier than one would expect from someone in the middle of a painting job. Nobody can judge this better than I. But the vendor was no drinking buddy of mine, not by a long shot. I had never sought the company of drinkers. I found the whole business most unpleasant. I mean, the newspaper seller really did not deserve to be treated like that. Fortunately, he seemed to know how to deal with it. I had set off late morning to offer my apologies for the distress caused by the article, but he could barely spare me the time of day. I found him standing in front of the kiosk, serving an extraordinarily large number of people, despite the cold, wet weather. A large sign hung above the sales window. Buy Bild, today featuring me and the loony YouTube Hitler.
Great timing, he called out when he saw me.
I had come to apologize, I called back.
But now I no longer know what for.
Me neither, the newspaper seller laughed.